According to my clock, it's 4:30, so I'm going to get started. My name is Jez Humble. I work for a company called ThoughtWorks Studios. We build tools to help people deliver great software, Mingle for agile project management, Go for agile release management, and Twist for automated testing. Can we turn the lights down at the front? Is that... Hello, people in control of the lights. Maybe I can do it. How about that? Mood lighting, you're welcome. This is actually the walk-in mode, so I guess I know what that means. So I wrote this, or co-wrote with a guy called Dave Farley, this book, Continuous Delivery. For some reason, I was not involved in the continuous deployment track. And instead, I've been asked to talk about something leadership-related. And so I'm going to talk about value. And this comes from my personal experience. I was product manager for this product Go for a couple of years. And so I'm kind of a recovering product manager. And this talk really is derived from my experiences being a product manager. And at ThoughtWorks, what tends to happen is if something needs to be done, they look around for someone who they think can do it and say, OK, you're doing this now. And that's what happened to me. I was a developer and a trainer and a sysadmin. And they said, OK, we need someone to be a product manager for this release management product. Go. And I knew nothing about product management. And so this is kind of me trying to make sense of it. I should say, you know, by the way, this product has moved on. I'm no longer the product manager. Nothing I say today should be considered to be reflecting on the product or the company as it is now, because things have changed in the last couple of years. So in terms of what I'm going to talk about in the next hour, what's my point? I believe that most of the stuff I was told and that I researched when I became a product manager is wrong. Who's a product manager or a product owner in this room? Okay, a few of you. Who is in product management in that kind of part of the organization, you know? Okay, any developers? Who's a developer? Lots of developers. Okay, cool. Analysts?
Can I ask a quick question?
Yeah.
They're actually taping you, and you show up a lot better in the light.
Oh, okay. Really? Like that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, maybe you're a...
Is there a way to...
A twilight?
Yeah, a hood.
A hood. There you go.
If I'd brought my shades. I don't think I have my shades. Okay. Well, I can't see you very well, but... testers? Any testers in the audience? Okay, a few of you. Anyone who hasn't put their hand up yet, doing something else? Okay, what are you doing? Person who I can't really see very well above the ledge. Okay, there's two people. Play nice. Okay, from the front. Okay, cool. And then someone else? Okay, you. Okay, a consultant stroke author type person. Okay, cool. So like a bunch of people doing things that aren't directly connected. So, okay, that's great. I believe that everything I was taught, or a lot of what I was taught, was wrong and unhelpful. A lot of software development in general follows the trust bridge model, and there was recently an article by someone really well known, whose name I forgot, who said, we should be building like engineers build buildings. That's wrong, completely wrong, and in as much as our project management techniques are derived from building trust bridges, they are completely unhelpful in working out how to build innovative software products and services. I hope you'll take away that we need to think completely differently about cost and value and portfolio management. We tend to think about cost a lot. If you're doing a good job, cost should be relatively unimportant, but it's the thing we spend the most time thinking about, and that's wrong. And we need to be thinking differently about culture and the culture of our organizations and how we create a culture in which people and the organization as a whole can learn to get better and prioritize that. So that's what I'm going to be talking about. If none of this is interesting to you, now would be a great time to go and see one of the other talks that's going on right now. Otherwise, hopefully, this will be interesting. So when I became a product owner, straight product manager, Dean Leffingwell will have you believe these are two separate things, and there's a 1-to-N mapping between them. I'm going to use the same word to mean both of them, product owner, product manager. I thought I had to work out what to build, do a bunch of prioritization and estimation, and then tell people what they'd done wrong at showcases. That was basically my job as I understood it. And that's, you know, from reading Scrum. I went to read the Scrum Guide to Product Management, and it's like, okay, well, this is what you've got to do. And I thought, okay, fine. So I worked out what to build. It was pretty easy. I came up with loads and loads and loads of stories. That was not a problem at all, like hundreds of those little guys. And I estimated them all, and we came up with a big backlog, and then we started building it. And one of the first decisions we made, which turned out to be a really good decision, was to get a customer. And we found someone in the same building as us who was building, working on a project at ThoughtWorks. And we said, hey, would you like us to be your CI server? And they said yes. And they became our customer. And we gave it to them. And they hated it. And they told us exactly why they hated it in great detail all the time. And that was really fabulous and useful and probably the best thing we could possibly have done, because it meant that we actually built something that was useful rather than something that I came up with in my head in the bath, which probably would not have been so useful. So that was my first kind of awakening. And that wasn't really written about anywhere that I read. It probably is in Scrum. Scrum is much more sensible than I tend to give it credit for. But this stuff turned out actually not to be that important. And so what I found is, reflecting on what I was doing, you know, I wrote this book, Continuous Delivery, with Dave Farley, and we got the title from this. This is the first principle of the Agile Manifesto. In as well as the this over that, there's 12 principles, and the first principle is this. Our highest priority is to satisfy the customer through early and continuous delivery of valuable software. And as well as the kind of subliminal advert of my book, this valuable software thing, that's really important, and it's not talked about very much. What is value? How do we determine value? And really, that's what I came away with from being a product owner, reading this and going, valuable software, what is value? What is value? What is it? How do we determine it? How do we measure it? How do we find out if we're doing it? And that, I believe, is insufficiently addressed. And I'm not going to answer that today. I'm going to give you some ideas that I've had and that other people have had that I like, which hopefully will lead you to think about it a lot more. Because in my opinion, it's the most important question you can possibly answer. What is value? How do we know that we're delivering it? How do we get better at delivering it? So it's something that other people have thought about. One of the most well understood definitions of value is shareholder value. So companies are expected to, by law, maximize profits for their shareholders. This is a couple of academics, Jensen and Meckling, who came up with a book called Theory of the Firm. And they said, well, this is what companies should do. And this is actually, you know, legally the case. People have sued directors of public companies or boards, and won because the boards were not doing this. You know, maximizing profits. That's what public company directors have to do. They're required to do that by law, which kind of makes Facebook a bit interesting, because they state explicitly they're not going to do that. So, but this has a problem. And the problem with this is there has been research done on this. And what you find is companies which best follow this rule are really bad at actually maximizing profits. If you set out to maximize profits, what happens is you do really badly at maximizing profits, which is unfortunate, because that's what people are supposed to do. It turns out that what's happened is, since this model has been very widespread, it's presided over a decline in the rate of return, both on equity investment and investment capital, accompanied by, guess who benefits from this? An eightfold increase in CEO compensation from 1980 to 2000. So what's happened? By following this model, shareholder returns have gone down, CEO compensation has gone up. Who could have predicted that? So this is not useful, really, as an idea on how to actually create value for shareholders or for anyone, really. So let's have a look at what some of the foremost entrepreneurs of our time have to say about delivering value. So who's heard of Elon Musk? Okay, many of you. So Elon Musk is an entrepreneur. He was one of the co-founders of PayPal and cashed out and made an absolute ton of money. And he decided, well, what am I going to do with this money? I'm going to build a space rocket. And that's exactly what he did. He started up this company called SpaceX. They're the first private company to send a vehicle to the International Space Station, called the Phoenix Module. This is what it looks like. Elon Musk's stated aim, well, let's see what their mission statement is. The company was founded in 2002 by Elon Musk to revolutionize space transport and ultimately make it possible for people to live on other planets. That's a fabulous mission statement. How cool is that? It's Elon Musk's stated aim to retire on Mars. And so he started to have a company, he's going to do it. And he's built a rocket ship in like 10 years or something that's gone to the ISS. And, you know, that's just the beginning for Elon Musk. He's not stopping there. In his spare time, he also co-founded a company called Tesla Motors. Anyone familiar with Tesla Motors? So their mission statement, they were founded in 2003 by a group of intrepid Silicon Valley engineers who set out to prove that electric vehicles could be awesome. It's another fabulous mission statement, talking about delivering value, going to make electric vehicles awesome. And, well, here we are in the Microsoft campus, so I figured I should probably say something nice about Bill Gates. The Gates Foundation, and I genuinely believe this is awesome, and this for me makes up for all the horrible times I've had installing Windows in my life. The Gates Foundation is guided by the belief that every life has equal value, and they work to help all people lead healthy, productive lives. That's very cool. I think that's awesome. What a great mission statement, and hopefully they do lots of really cool things, as they're already doing. But you don't have to be Bill Gates or Elon Musk to do something awesome. And it's really important to bear that in mind. It's very easy to be like, well, these dudes are totally amazing and we can't possibly do anything like them. So I want you to meet Jack Andraker. So Jack Andraker, anyone heard of Jack Andraker? One person, okay, so not as famous. He was the winner of the 2012 Intel Science Fair. And what he did to win that was he produced a diagnostic tool for pancreatic cancer. His uncle died from pancreatic cancer, and he made a diagnostic tool using carbon nanotubes coated with antibodies to detect proteins commonly associated with pancreatic cancer. And his sensor is 100 times more selective than existing diagnostic tests. It's 25,000 times less expensive, 400 times more sensitive. And, you know, I think he's 16 or something, you know, and he researched it all using Google and used a lab where he got access to the technology he needed. So 16-year-old builds an amazing diagnostic test for pancreatic cancer using Google and some carbon nanotubes he found kicking around the place. Which is pretty cool. You know, in terms of delivering value, here's someone who's unquestionably delivered value. And I read an interview with him, and they asked him, well, how is it that you turned into this person who is able to do this really awesome thing? And he said this. His parents, he said, never really answered any of the questions they had, him and his siblings. Go figure it out for yourself, they would say. I got really into the scientific method of developing a hypothesis and testing it and getting a result and going back to do it again. So I'm a parent. I've got two daughters, and obviously I want them to be fabulous and wonderful and successful. And, you know, I think quite a lot about how I'm going to do that. And so I often think, well, you know, you've got to buy them a lot of encyclopedias and spend a lot of time teaching them stuff. And so this is really interesting to me that his parents are basically like, work it out for yourself. That's an interesting parenting method, but one that's obviously extremely successful, at least by this existence proof. Who else is a parent in this room? Okay, so here's a valuable life lesson for you. And I think that he's really hit the nail on the head. There's something very important about this. And it turns out the scientific method is a really important tool when it comes to working out what is valuable. So with that in mind, I just want to show you a quote from Jack Welch. So Jack Welch used to be the CEO of GE, and he had this to say about shareholder value. Shareholder value is the dumbest idea in the world. It is a result, not a strategy. Your main constituents are your employees, your customers, and your products. Which I think is very insightful. So we're going to look at those three things over the course of the next 45 minutes. Let's start with customers. You might think, you know, if you want to deliver value, what you should do is you should ask your customers what they want and then go and build that for them. That seems like a logical thing to do, right? Well, if there's one thing we all know about customers, This is a great quote from a book by two very smart dudes, which won the Shingo Prize actually recently. Users are unable to articulate exactly what they need, yet they seem insistent about what they don't want once they see it. who's experienced this before? This is very common. So if you ask people what they want, they say, I want a blah, 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 and then you go and build it to them, and you say, hey, I've done your thing for you. And they're like, no, that's not what I want at all. That's awful. I want all these things instead. That's totally wrong. So, you know, you can't really ask people what they want. They might think they know what they want. Often they don't even know what's possible. Unless they're working in technology. I mean, I work in technology. I read the interwebs all day. And I'm constantly finding really awesome things that I had no idea about that are really cool. And this is my job. So all our customers whose job isn't to keep abreast with what's going on in the world have no idea what's possible. So we can ask them what they want. And they're going to, you know, I remember when I started in 2000 in the dot-com boom in London, working for some guy who was going to create Hotmail, but like with a desk, with a dog, who like graphically brought your like, post to you as an email, and it was a graphic and you would click on it and you would read your email that way. And you know, it was a terrible idea. And you know, this was someone who had money and wanted a product build and had no idea. I mean, they thought they knew what they wanted, but they didn't. And you know, this is very common. So you can't ask people what they want. What should we do instead? Well, who's heard of the Lean Startup movement? Okay, a few of you. Well, these guys pretty much have cracked it. I think there's a few things. Using anthropological techniques, field work, the well-known quote is leave the building, get out of the building, go and study people and look at what they're doing. Don't ask them, experiment on them. Experiment on your subjects, and then finally drink your own champagne, which I think is a nice alternative to eat your own dog food, because who wants to eat dog food, really? This is a crazy thing to say. Drink your own champagne. So the Lean Startup, basically what they say about delivering value to your customers is, okay, you've got to have a vision. What change do you want to achieve in the world? What's the measurable change that you want to achieve? And then these slides are old. It shouldn't be make a business model. You don't want to do anything very complex, maybe a business canvas or something like that. And then work out what the smallest possible amount of work is to test your product hypothesis. What we tend to do when we have a new product idea, a hypothesis, is we spend a lot of time building huge requirements documents, and then we go and actually build the thing in order to find out if it will be valuable, which is the most inefficient possible way to validate your hypothesis, is to actually go and build it. That's kind of nuts, but that's what we do. So what we should do instead is work out how we can run an experiment by doing a very small amount of work and testing something which is not the real product to find out if our idea is valuable. And that might be something really dumb like a lo-fi prototype. It might be some working HTML that's interactive but doesn't have very much in the way of business logic behind the hood. It could be, so IBM famously, there's this concept of prototyping. IBM back in the day, when they first had computers, they thought, these computers are great and I bet we can do things other than calculating long divisions really fast. There's probably some other uses for this thing. And so someone had the bright idea they were going to create a dictation machine. And so what they did is, rather than actually building some software for transcribing dictation, which no one had any idea what to do, they thought, well, let's test this idea. And they had a room with some dudes with a keyboard and a loudspeaker, and another room somewhere else with an executive and a screen and a microphone. And they said to the executive, okay, we'd like to demonstrate our new transcribing software. Please go and dictate your letter so we can test it. And the executive said, well, I'd like to write a letter to, oh no, don't start typing yet. No, I'm not ready. No, don't type, I'm not ready. No, stop. No, don't type, stop. And it quickly became clear this was a rubbish idea and it wasn't going to work at all. And here we are in 2013, in fact, wow, that was quick, with, you know, Siri, which is still not, you know, perfect in any way. So, you know, good that they didn't actually try and build anything, because they would have wasted a lot of money. So think MVP. What's the smallest amount of work you can do to experiment to find out if your idea has legs, other than actually going and building it, which is really inefficient and wasteful? So once you've done that, test, iterate, and then you might find, I mean, there's three possibilities. One, it's a rubbish idea. Great, cancel, get out while you're ahead. Two, it's an okay idea. People, you know, would pay for it, but it's not going to make you tons of money. In which case, what you might do is pivot, which is change your business plan, but still achieve the same vision. So we're going to achieve the same vision, but we're going to use a different business model in order to actually achieve that vision. Or you might find actually people really like it and you're just, you know, adding new features incrementally to it, and that's doing great. And when you do that, you reach a local maximum, and at that point you might decide to pivot again. So this is their idea. Seems very sensible to me. But it has an implication for software development. We have a process for developing software, and the idea is this. What we should do is, you know, we have ideas, we build something, write some code, we measure the change in customer outcome as a result of doing that work. What's the change in customer behavior? We gather data and we learn, we work out what to do next. And the idea is what we should do is go through this loop as quickly as possible and optimize our software delivery process to go around this loop as quickly as possible. And that's kind of what continuous delivery is all about, by the way, is working out how to reduce the transaction cost of putting out change so we can iterate as fast as possible. That actually has an interesting impact on project management. It means you want to optimize for lead time through this loop. And when you optimize for lead time, what happens is you sub-optimize for utilization. You can actually prove this using queue theory. So the managers who go around saying, or especially financial people who go around saying, our people need to be fully utilized. We want 100% utilization. By doing that, you create the most inefficient process you possibly can for actually getting changes out to users. Phase gate methodologies, organizational silos, they make it basically impossible to do this because the transaction costs of going from dev to test and test to ops and getting data from your users is just too high. So then you have to batch up the changes, and those batches tend to get bigger and bigger, and then you can't do this. So that's a problem. You know, you might hear this whole lean startup thing, and it might sound great to you, or it might not. often people say, well, that just sounds like a load of crap. And actually, what we should be doing is running software development as if we're building bridges, which is you spend a lot of time coming up with the requirements for the bridge, and then you go and build it based on the requirements document, and then it works and doesn't fall down. Which is good, and that's one of the reasons that people like the kind of whole architectural approach, is that, you know, bridges don't tend to fall down, as opposed to software, which tends to break all the time and get people into big trouble. So there's a whole school of thought that says, no, we shouldn't do this, that's a terrible idea, or that might work for your nice little kind of website selling shoes, but it's not going to work for my proper financial services thing where we have to care about regulation. And I think, actually, there's a problem with this, and the problem is, if you go and look at architects who did things that were innovative, you find out that actually they weren't doing the whole waterfall thing anyway. If you're building a truss bridge, truss bridges you can model. They're very easy to model. There's a mathematical model. You plug in the numbers, out comes the truss bridge, and off you go and build it, and it's probably not going to go wrong. But if you're not building a truss bridge, if you're doing something a bit different, a bit innovative, you can't use that model. Who's been to the Sagrada Familia in Barcelona? Anyone? Okay, a few of you. Isn't it amazing? What a really cool and awesome building. And it's been over 100 years in the building. And it's kind of nuts. It's really crazy inside. It might aesthetically be a bit kind of unusual, but it's just really an astonishing building and totally breathtaking. So needless to say, nobody had built anything like this before. So what do you think Gaudi did? Do you think Gaudi went and built a very large requirements document and then handed it to the builders and said, off you go, come back in 100 years when you're done? Turns out he didn't do that. That was not how the Sagrada Familia was built. He basically, if you go down into the crypt of the Sagrada Familia, what you find out is he was forever tinkering with scale models. He would build things and try them out and see what happened. And he created a completely new style of architecture called hyperbolic architecture. So a lot of the curves in the parts of the building that support weight, the load-bearing parts of the building, are hyperbolic in form. No one had done this before. He actually played around with the parabolic style as well. People were using, the style at the time was Gothic perpendicular, lots of straight lines. People generally liked straight lines in their buildings at that time, and this whole hyperbola thing was kind of considered a bit out there. And so, you know, you don't want to build something this large with a an exciting new technique for building your load-bearing structures and then find out that it doesn't work and it's going to fall down. So what he did is he built models. And he built a small church using this style to test out whether or not it would actually work. And he did this really cool thing. That original church that he built in the hyperbolic style, he did this cool thing where he created a scale model using... It was upside down, and it used weights to simulate the load on the structure. And he used this to make sure that actually the architectural, the load-bearing structures would support the weight that was going to be placed on them. That's really cool. He totally invented this, and it's a brilliant way to actually model out without having to use maths. The maths is not analytically tractable for these kinds of things. And this is what people do. And architects generally do a lot more of this than is commonly thought, especially when they're doing things that are unusual. So this idea that, in fact, when you do something innovative, you're going to test things out and build models and try things and not actually go and build the whole thing based on some document we've written out. This is not the way that architects build innovative structures. They build scale models, they experiment, they try things out. Another great example of innovation, who's got a fondle slab? Anyone got one of these? Okay, just a few of you. Who's got the Windows phone? Anyone? More of you have got the Windows phone. Excellent. Good citizens. That's great. And any Android type people? Okay, a few of you. All right. So, you know, when the iPhone came out, it was considered really amazing and innovative. And Apple have a reputation for secrecy, you know, that they don't tell anyone anything. So it might look under the hood as if they're doing kind of a very waterfall-y kind of thing. They're not doing experiments because they want to keep everything secret. Who knows what Apple's very first product was? Anyone? Very first product that Apple built? The Apple One, absolutely right. So, the Apple One doesn't look quite like this. It looks more like this. It was built in Steve Wozniak's parents' garage. This is quite MVP. It didn't come with a keyboard or a power supply. You had to supply that. But it did something, it had some pretty innovative stuff in it. I mean, it had onboard read-only memory and a video interface and some other cool things that no one had thought to do until then. I mean, video interfaces on personal computers, basically the Apple One was the first one to do this. So, you know, in terms of MVP versus secretive waterfall, you know, Exhibit A, Exhibit B. Exhibit A, Exhibit B. Quite different. And this was built through tinkering, through experimentation. And the Apple One never really took off. It was never really a world-beating product. The Apple II is the product that really shot Apple to some kind of fame. And then the one that most people actually have heard of who are around today is the Macintosh, obviously. That was the one that really made them very profitable and successful. And so the Apple Macintosh was not the product that they wanted to build off the Apple II. That was the Lisa. And the Lisa was built using very waterfall-y approaches, and it failed, in fact. It was never really successful. And Steve Jobs pulled off a bunch of really smart people and created the Macintosh team. And he had some rules. The team was not allowed to be bigger than 100 people, and they all had to sit together in the building. And they didn't do a waterfall-y thing. What they did... there's actually a book that was written about this by Andy Hertzfeld and a bunch of other people involved in it. And there's a site called folklore.org, which is really worth reading, which has got all these stories in it. And this is just a quote from one of the stories. Instead of arguing about new software ideas, we actually tried them out by writing quick prototypes, keeping the ideas that work best and discarding the others. We always had something running that represented our best thinking at the time. So it was tinkering. That's how they built this product. And they were very clever about their tinkering. They actually made sure that they could tinker even in the hardware. So what he did is he used programmable logic arrays to do all the logic in the machine. And he would, you know, if he wanted to experiment, I think this wasn't Andy Hertzfeld. This is one of the other guys on the team whose name escaped from me at the moment. But he was in charge of the hardware. And if they found that the hardware stuff wasn't working right, they would reflash the ULA and try a new configuration of some of the firmware. So they could actually experiment with the firmware in much the same way they could experiment with the software. And they built the system with that in mind, that they were going to have to tinker with the way the firmware was designed and the operating system, and they designed the hardware so that they could do that, so they could be very iterative about the way they built it. So no one knows how Apple works these days inside, but early on in Apple's history, this model won over the Lisa model of doing something very waterfally. And my guess is that they're still doing a lot of tinkering when they innovate these days, and that they design their systems to be able to tinker. And when you innovate, you know, it seems to me that all the examples that I've seen about successful innovation are done through smart people tinkering. But the Apple people had an advantage, which was that they were basically building for themselves. They were drinking their own champagne. They were building something that pleased them, that they wanted to use. And many of us, who's in that position, that the thing that they're building is something they would actually use, and so they can just ask themselves? Okay, a few of you. Who's in a position where you're building something for someone who you basically don't really identify with? A lot more of you. That's really hard, it turns out. Because if you're not building for yourself, you know, it's hard to get feedback on whether what you're doing is actually valuable to those people if you don't identify with them. And so this is why personas are really important. Who uses personas in their product process? Yeah, so it's a very common technique. The idea is that you basically get a copy of Vogue, cut out some people, stick them on the wall and kind of imagine what they're like and use them to frame all the requirements and stories that you build. More or less. And there's more to it than that, but I'm summarising for time. So there's a guy called Richard Sheridan who works for a company called Menlo Innovation. And they have an exercise that they do when they build, when they help companies build products. So they're a consultancy. They help people build stuff. And what they do is they put a series of concentric targets on a table like this. And you get all your personas. And you're allowed to put one persona in the middle of the target. So right in the middle, there's only one person. That's your primary customer. And what Richard Sheridan says is that his customers have a real problem with this. They don't want to choose one person who's the number one, or one persona who's the number one customer. They say things like, we want to dominate the sector, and things like this that basically are a get-out clause, so they don't have to choose one persona that's going to be the main customer. And so he was doing this exercise for a company that built medical devices. And the product owner, you know, they went through this exercise and the product owner looked at the persona who ended up in the middle and said, you know what, I can't relate to this person. And Richard Sheridan says to them, how many of these widgets are you buying? And he says, none. And so Richard says to him, well, why should I care what you think? And the product owner says, that's the area of your process I'm still having trouble with. And it's a problem. If as the product owner, you don't really understand the needs of the customer, which you might not, I mean, it's very common, how do you actually work out what's valuable to them? How do you measure value? So I'm going to talk about that for a bit. It turns out there's a bunch of techniques for measuring value. It's not easy. But then, you know, we didn't become engineers to do easy things. But it's possible. So A/B testing, obviously a very common one. If you're using websites, you produce two versions of a particular page and you see which one leads to more conversions. And it's not just how many people click through, it's how many people actually pay you money at the end of the transaction. You have to go all the way through the business process and compare the results at the end. And A/B testing is very trendy. It actually comes from bulk mailing. So all that junk mail you get in your mailbox, they don't send the same credit cards approval letter. You've been pre-approved for this fabulous credit card. That's the different text for different people, and they see which ones actually end up getting the credit card. So it's a deeply untrendy technology that has become very, very trendy in the world of websites. A really cheap way to find out if people like what you've done is to build a prototype and to show it to them and get them to use it and see how they interact with it. So you can do that very easily with software. These days, you can do it very easily with hardware as well. We live in a world of 3D printing. We have Arduinos and Raspberry Pis. It's really trivial to prototype hardware these days and show that to users and watch them interact with it. And I'm pretty sure that Apple does quite a lot of that. We can measure business metrics. Every company has business metrics. Every time they put out a new release, you can see the result on your business metrics. And this is, you know, the whole big data thing. This is one of the primary things that we should be focusing on in terms of big data. How do we actually get actionable feedback from our data on what the effect of putting out a new product is, and make sure we prioritize getting that data as soon as possible? And then there's surveys, social media, a whole bunch of things. So there's a lot of tools out there for doing this. And often the people in charge of those tools are not connected to the people doing the product development. And that feedback loop is really slow and painful. And that's one of the biggest problems in enterprise development. The people who are doing the metric stuff are not the people who are involved in product management, and they don't collaborate very well. And so this feedback loop is really painful. So let me give you an example of a company which did a pretty good job of this. This was a company which presented at Eric Ries's Startup Lessons Learned conference in 2001. And it doesn't really matter what they were building. It's a tool for getting people to interact with government better. But what's interesting, I think, is the way they changed their tool in response to metrics. So in terms of actually measuring how people interact with your system, there's a very well-known framework called R, Acquisition, Activation, Referrals, Retention, Revenue, R. I come from the West Country in England, where we actually speak like that. So that really appeals to me. So the idea is, you know, you acquire customers, people come to your website, they activate their user account, they refer other people, then they come back and use it again, and then they give you money. That's the model, more or less. And so they came out with version 1.0 of their service. It took them 6 weeks to build version 1.0, and they spent $1,206. And what they found out is this: they got 5% acquisition, people who actually went past page one on their site, and 17% of those people then activated their accounts, but then they didn't refer anyone else, and there, you know, there was nothing beyond that. So turns out that wasn't a very good idea. And what they did is they farted around with it a bit. They took their idea and kind of added some more features to it to see if maybe we were lacking some features, which, by the way, when your product doesn't do very well and you spent ages building it and everyone's really bought into how fabulous this product is, what normally do they say is the problem?
Customers.
You're all right, so the customers, exactly. And what's wrong with the customers?
They don't get it.
So what are we going to do to make them get it? We're going to build more stuff. We haven't got enough features. It's not feature rich enough. We need to build more features, and then they'll really love it. And then they'll pay us all their money. So, you know, it's a fair point. You know, you might go down that route and see if we can convert some more customers by building some more features. And so they did that, and they found out, you know, 17% acquisition. So that number went up. 90% activation. Fabulous. 4% referrals, 5% retention. But unfortunately, no one was paying them any money, so that was bad. And they thought, well, okay, at this point, you know, we've gone as far as we can. We've reached the local maximum. No one's paying us any money. We can't actually survive because we're a startup if people don't give us money. So then pivot, change the business model, start again. We're going to achieve the same vision, which is getting people to interact better with their elected representatives. That was their kind of vision. And so they came up with something else, version 2. And fabulous, 42% acquisition. And these numbers are all great. And we even make some money. Wow, brilliant. So making money is good. And so what they said is, OK, at this point, we're definitely going to pursue this business model. We're going to create a bunch more features. Actually, I think what they said for version 2 is 1%, that's not good enough. We're going to start again. They came up with a different business model. And they started again. And these numbers are all looking great, until the revenue went down to 0%. And then that was bad. So they pivoted again. And finally, they came up with something where they were getting a decent amount of money. And they stuck with that. That was the website they ended up with. And then they started building more features once they had a business model that was actually sustainable. So 3 pivots to get them there. How long did that take them? Well, it took them 18 months to go all the way from left to right. And it took them $120,000. And then they got a bunch of money. But they changed their business model 3 times in the process of doing that. And that's because they had this really tight feedback loop, and they were able to actually build something really quickly, get feedback on the business idea, and then pivot. There's a book coming out, hopefully later this year, by a guy called Jeff Gothelf, called Lean UX. And he and another guy gave a presentation last year where they came up with this idea, which I think is really fabulous. And it's not really a new idea, but it's kind of popularized by them. Called hypothesis-driven delivery. And the idea is, you know, everyone, Who's using kind of agile methodologies and stories? Who's using stories? Okay, lots of you. So stories are, you know, as a X, I want blah, so that I can get yay. That's kind of the format in which we write stories. You know, persona, what you're going to build, what the value is that it delivers. And the problem is that those things, those stories, they're written as if this will make us lots of money or this will deliver the expected value to the customers. But of course, you don't know that. You don't know that until you've actually built it. And so what you have is not a requirement, it's a hypothesis. And so their idea basically is, well, if it's a hypothesis, let's actually write it as a hypothesis and build it as a hypothesis. So instead of as a X, I want Y so that yay, it is, we believe that building this feature for these people will achieve this outcome. We will know we're successful when we see this signal from the market. And so it's a reframing of the whole idea of how we build features. Instead of we're going to build this and it's going to deliver this value, it's we think this thing will be valuable. This is the expected customer outcome. And this is how we're going to measure to find out if we've actually achieved that expected customer outcome. So in terms of what is value? We're guessing what is value, and we're putting measuring the expected value at the heart of the features that we're building. How do we measure the expected value and find out if what we're doing is actually valuable? And often it turns out to be hard to work out how you're going to measure the value. And if it's hard to work out how to measure the value, what that means is not, oh, then this is a dumb idea and we shouldn't do it because it's hard to measure the value. That's not the right response. The response is, oh gosh, that means this is really risky because we've got no way of knowing if it's actually going to be valuable. And so maybe we shouldn't build something that we have no idea whether or not it's going to be valuable. That's really risky. Instead, maybe we should change it a bit to find some way to build something where we can actually measure the value, because at least we'll then know if we're actually wasting our time or if we're doing something that customers will find valuable. So I think this is actually a really great idea in terms of building new products, and even adding features to existing products is thinking in this way. And this changes the whole way we do analysis and requirements. And it also changes actually how we deliver. So who's heard of kind of the importance of the definition of done? Great, lots of you. So there's this idea, you know, you go to a developer and you say, are you done with your feature? And they say, yes, I'm done on my feature. It works on my machine. And you say, well, are you done, right? Because that's something completely different. You know, works in production versus works on my feature branch, two completely different things, and often most of the pain and volatility comes in between those. But, you know, in continuous delivery, we talk about done means released, but we can go beyond that, actually. And so in the Lean Startup, Eric Ries gives the example of Grokket, and their definition of done is this. User stories were not considered complete until they led to validated learning, until we found out if the story was actually valuable to have built in the first place. So getting it to production isn't good enough. You need to get it to production and then gather data to find out if it was actually valuable. That's when you're done, if you know it was a good idea to have built in the first place. So I think that's a very interesting idea. And again, it changes the way we do analysis and the way we do product management. So how do we measure value? I think, you know, one good proxy for that is people using it. And there's a great quote from a guy who's actually a writer, and he's talking about writing books. And writing books, as anyone who's written one will tell you, is pretty thankless as a job. And he has this advice for writers. Using a product, above all, is a transaction. The user donates her time and attention, which are supremely valuable commodities. In return, you, the creator, must give her something worthy of her gift to you. And I think this is really useful advice, not just for writers, but also for product owners. You know, when you, every product owner is convinced that their product is fabulous and a gift to creation and the best thing ever. And that leads to lots of bad behaviors, such as, you know, adding more features to make sure that it really is the best thing ever, and causing scope creep and the large batch death spiral and so forth. And so it's important that the subtitle of this article is "Nobody Wants to Read Your Shit." That's the subtitle for this article. And I think that's also true of customers. You know, Eric Ries tells a story of building his website And he was really worried because the quality wasn't as good as he was wanting. There was a bunch of bugs in it, so they released it. This is InVue. And it turned out he didn't need to worry at all, because what happened is no one used it. No one went past the very first page on the website to press the download button. No one pressed the download button. And so that was great, because he didn't need to worry about the bugs. Also kind of depressing, because it just wasted 6 months on something that no one wanted. And that's, you know, that's depressing. And it's something we don't sufficiently consider up front, that nobody might actually care what you're building. And so a good proxy for value is people actually using it, and you need to consider that. The point is not actually money. The point is achieving your vision. You have a vision of what you want to achieve, and what you want to deliver is a measurable customer outcome. And so if no one's going to pay for it or use it, your vision doesn't matter. And if someone pays for it, if management buys a product on a golf course, but nobody in the company actually wants to use that product, rational, then you've got a problem. And it's the same with time and expenses systems. People put all this money into time and expenses systems, and then no one uses them because they're mandated to. I mean, time and expenses systems you have to use, because otherwise you don't get paid. But then it's not very easy to measure the value of that, because someone's, you know, people are forced to use it or they don't get paid. So actually working out if someone's going to use it is a great proxy for value for money. So with all this stuff in mind, I kind of want to revisit the role of the product manager or the product owner. What's the job of the product manager, the product owner? So first of all, you have to have a vision. What's the change that you're going to achieve in the world? What's the measurable customer outcome that you want to see as a result of that? And so the first job as a product owner, when you're going to start a new product or service, is this. Define the measurements by which you will know that you have succeeded. What's the measurable customer outcome? And then these are things that the team should be able to measure. You shouldn't need to, you know, define all that. The team should help define and build the measurements by which you'll know if you've actually succeeded in accomplishing your vision. And then you just have to run a bunch of experiments. You use the scientific method. Build some stuff, run some experiments to find out if your idea is any good by trying to get the data that you need to validate your idea as quickly and cheaply as possible. And then optimize your process for cycle time. And finally, quality. What you're doing is everyone's responsibility. So the idea is to move away from this idea that, you know, the product manager knows everything. Because this is the problem I have with Scrum, is the implicit thing in Scrum is that the product owner is right. The team doesn't have any input into what the product owner says. You know, the product owner defines the vision, and then the product owner kind of lays it out, and then people go away and build it. And the product owner is you know, the source of all knowledge about what's valuable. And that's not true. The one thing you can definitely say is that the product owner will be wrong. And I've certainly experienced that many, many times. I've said, this feature will be fabulous, and everyone will love it, and then no one cares about it, and I was wrong. So I think the most important thing you can do as a product manager is help the team to understand the value of what you're building and work out ways that they can measure it and build those measurements into the features that they're developing. That's your job as a product owner. Work out the vision and then say to the team, okay, how are we going to measure that this is valuable? How are we going to build that into our features? What experiments are we going to run? That's what we need to do. So that changes the way that we do product development. What we should be doing is you have an inception at the beginning. And the inception is an activity where the team comes together and works out, what's the vision? How are we going to measure the customer outcome? And what's the experiments that we're going to run to gather that data? And that's something that should take you, you know, a few days, a couple of weeks maybe, because crucially, what you want to do is not spend a year or two building it, but run an experiment in a few weeks tops to validate your business idea and your vision. And then go and build that thing. Build the minimum viable product. And then at the end of that, you'll have either, this is a horrible idea, we should cut our losses and quit. Or this is an okay idea, maybe we should pivot. Or this is a fabulous idea and we should carry on delivering features. And then, you know, in option three, you can carry on delivering features. And every time you push out a new feature, you can measure the impact on customer outcome. Did it improve our whatever it is that's valuable? Say, for example, Amazon do this all the time. There's a really staggering quote from Amazon, and this is where it kind of ties back to continuous delivery. I've put this in a different presentation, so if you'll just give me a second, I will get up the other presentation where I put this number up for you. Amazon, in May of last year, they had these deployment stats. They're deploying in Amazon every 11.6 seconds to production on average. They have up to 1,000 deployments per hour in Amazon. And mean average number of hosts receiving a deployment, 10,000 hosts, 10,000 boxes receiving a deployment every time a new deploy goes out, and up to 30,000. And what are they using this for? They're using this to push out tiny little changes. You'll notice, you know, that the buy box on Amazon is always changing. They're moving things around, they're adding new things. There's now a rent thing. The rent was below the buy button, then it was above the buy button, and then there was the number of copies. They're always changing things on Amazon all the time to experiment, to find out, can we make more money for our customers? Can we improve our customer experience? Can we get more retention? All these kinds of things. This is why they do continuous deployment, so they can gather data as fast as possible from their customers on what to build and work out how to improve the customer experience of the system. So in terms of the point of continuous delivery, this is the point. So you can learn from your customers as rapidly as possible. I mean, so that's those are really exciting numbers. And it's right over there on the other side of Seattle. Work out what you're going to build, work out how you're going to measure it, work out the MVP, build that thing, get feedback, keep delivering small increments. And in terms of the product management side of things, there's a fabulous book by Don Reinertsen called The Principles of Product Development Flow, which I highly recommend. Anyone who's interested in kind of methodology, the whole kind of, you know, how to be a project manager for this kind of thing, that's a really great book. So I want to talk briefly in a couple of minutes about productivity and kind of cost. Because these, you know, the third thing that Jack Welch talks about is your employees. They're your third set of constituents. And so one of the things we've talked about is measuring customer outcomes. What about measuring employees? And so there's this concept of productivity in software development. How do we measure productivity? Who's a developer who's measured by the number of lines of code they deliver? Anyone? Okay, well, that's great. I was in China recently talking to a very large manufacturer who you will all have heard of, and that, you know, lines of code is still measured by them. So lines of code is a stupid thing to measure because a line of code is a liability, not an asset. And in fact, some companies actually, Mike Nygaard visited a company where the auditors wanted to put a hook into Subversion to measure the number of lines of code that were being added and deleted with every check-in, because that would have an impact on their financial statement, because they measured lines of code as an asset. Lines of code are not an asset, they're a liability. Every time you add lines of code, that increases the maintenance cost of the thing you're building and makes it harder to change. Ideally, the best and most efficient way to deliver value to your customers is not to write software at all. And if you can possibly do that, for God's sake, don't write any software. That's really the best way to do something very efficiently. But if you have to write software, write as little as possible, because you're going to want to change it. And if you write a lot of software, it's going to be really painful to change it. Who's a tester who's measured by the number of bugs found? Any testers measured by the number of bugs they find? Okay. Any companies? Anyone work for a company where they measure testers by number of bugs found? Okay, you guys are all terribly enlightened, or you're not admitting to it. So that's a really stupid measure as well, because it's a sign that we haven't done a good job of building quality into the thing that we're delivering. If we've done a good job as developers, the testers shouldn't be finding any bugs, and that should be fabulous, and we should all celebrate that. How about number of hours worked? Who gets a bonus if they work extra hard? Okay, well, the consultants in the audience, obviously. but this is a problem, because what tends to happen if you measure hours worked is that people don't work at a sustainable pace. And if you really drive, all the industrial research shows that the more hours people work over 40 hours, the more stupid things they do. And then you have to fix those stupid things, and that's really expensive. So rewarding people for working more than 40 hours is dumb, because it just makes the software more buggy. Because people are stupid because they're working too many hours, and then they do dumb things that you have to come up and fix later. And in my experience, you know, there's always some hero who's worked at a company for ages who's really smart, and they come and save the day at the end. Those people are normally the people who caused the problem in the first place. Just saying, in my experience. So not a great thing to measure. what should we be measuring? And I think, you know, the problem is we're focused on measuring cost. What's the cost of our resources? You know, resources instead of, to mean people is obviously a horrible term because it's people. But it's something we often measure. And there's this great tweet by this guy that I've never heard of before, which I think sums it up beautifully. The cost center pattern fills the vacuum of our inability to define, model and measure the value most workers create for their organization. We shouldn't be measuring cost. We should be measuring value. And there's a great quote by Doug Hubbard, who wrote a book called How to Measure Anything. And he says this about costs. Even in projects with very uncertain development costs, we haven't found that those costs have a significant information value for the investment decision. So we spend all this time estimating. And that's, you know, as a product owner, that's something you spend a lot of time doing. Backlog grooming, estimating, planning. In my opinion, mainly worthless activities. Estimating is basically not a value-add activity, because if you're doing a good job, the cost should be very small compared to the return on investment. Otherwise, there was no point in building it in the first place. So spending all this time estimating and measuring the cost of delivering something because it's easier than measuring the value we're delivering is a waste of time. We should be focusing on measuring the value we're delivering, not measuring the cost of delivering it, because that should be much higher than the cost of delivering it. But the problem is it's hard to measure value and it's easy to measure cost. And so we measure cost instead. But it's not a smart thing to do. And prioritization, by the way, is kind of not a valuable activity either, because what we should be doing, if you follow a Kanban model, what you do is when capacity becomes available in the system to work on something, your development team has capacity, at that point, you should work on whatever the most valuable thing is to do right now. So the prioritization decision should be made just in time based on what's the output of the measurement from the last thing we did. That will inform the next thing we decide to do. So based on we put something out, what's the value that delivered? That will inform the next decision, what we do next, and we can make that decision just in time. So anyone who's spending a lot of time on estimating and prioritization, not actually very valuable activities when you consider the wider scope of building innovative products and services. So finally, how do we improve? So there's a great book by Toyota Katta, and I'm kind of running out of time. I want to leave some time for questions, but I would suggest going and reading this book. The idea is that the job of management is to teach the rest of the organization how to get really good at running experiments so they can go and run experiments and work out what to build. Optimize your development process so you can run experiments as fast as possible. Build organizations that are designed to learn fast from that experimental process. And experiments could be building new features. It could also be trying to change our methodology. Maybe we're going to try unit testing. Maybe we're going to try pair programming. How, you know, instead of saying the whole organization is going to go agile and we're going to do all this stuff, don't do that. Find a way to run an experiment. Have this team, who's interested in doing pair programming and they are capable of doing it, have them do it for 2 weeks and come back and find out what the benefits and the downside was to it. Run experiments and find ways to measure the value delivered. So finally, I just want to leave you with this thought. I'll leave the last word to 15-year-old Jack Andraker, and he says this. In terms of what is value, make sure to be passionate about whatever it is you get into, because otherwise you won't put the right amount of work into it. What is value? Value is ultimately what gives our lives meaning. It's what makes us want to get up in the morning and do something. We want to change the world. We want to make the world better. We want to do something for people around us. That's why we exist. So before you do anything, think. If you could go out of this room right now and you knew that whatever you did would succeed, what would you do? And think about that. What would you do if you knew that whatever it was would be successful? And then find a bunch of like-minded people, pursue it, follow the scientific method, find some way to deliver that value. If you could guarantee you wouldn't fail, what would you do? Find some way to do that. We have 1 minute for questions. Any questions?
And I have a mic up here if you want to raise your hand and I can run it to you. Of course, you're standing between them and the brewery.
Am I?
Yeah.
Well, that was bad timing.
Yeah. Anybody?
Okay, well, my details are up here. Feel free to get in touch. I obviously welcome feedback, so please give me your feedback. Feel free to tweet anything. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jess.